Well, hello everyone, and welcome to the Deepest Lore. I'm here once again with Simon. You've had rave reviews, Simon. You're being talked up as the MVP of these Curtis streams. So.
What's MVP? What's that? I saw the new baby face.
MVP is American for man of the match. I think it means most valuable player in American football terms. But they apply it to other sports as well. The MVP.
Fantastic.
The man of the match, essentially.
Many very kind comments. Thank you very much. Good evening, chat. Good evening, AA. And it was a good stream last week. Looking forward to more.
Do you know, in my schoolboy football career, Simon, I only got man of the match once when I was 14. I remember the match as well. I was playing centre back that day. And it was a rainy day. I was really putting in those slide tackles that day. And I got man of the match. And I was mentioned by the, in the assembly where they call out,
The problem is with school football teams, they don't really have a manager. And they should have recognized the nascent Alex Ferguson of YouTube.
Yeah, I should have been the manager, yeah.
Literally, coordinating the action, yeah.
Yeah, tactics.
How are you feeling today? Is it cooler down there?
Yeah, well, yes. In fact, it was raining yesterday. And I was, I have a mortal fear of slugs, Simon.
Tell me. Yeah.
Somehow, yesterday, a slug actually got on the ceiling inside. I was like,
"Yeah,
oh my God, what do I do?" And it was like, it was like being in Alien.
It is, isn't it? I get them in the living room sometimes, on the carpet. I don't know how the hell they get in.
And I'm serious. I put on two pairs of rubber gloves.
Yeah.
Got a kind of long pair of tongs with gloves on, and a sheet of paper. And I was like, trying to. I really have got a. Do you remember last week? I was talking about if I was in room 101.
Yeah.
Crowds would be there. Probably the second thing after that would be slugs. I really hate them.
Horrific, vile creatures. I just scoop them up usually and put them in the bin and salt them, execute them immediately. I've just got no feeling for these animals whatsoever.
Being a humanitarian, I didn't salt this one. I just kind of squeaked him and, threw him out. I think he was still alive. So
It's horrible. The factor of the changing weather. But still, I'm feeling slightly wistful because summer is waning like a guttering candle and a tinge of melancholy. Suffusing the dampening air. We're just drifting towards the season of mists and mellow fruitfulness and massive astroturf government riots.
Yes, indeed. Talking about manufacturing consent and engineering consent, which we're currently involved in, there's definitely some sort of government operation happening as we speak. We're going to be talking about that in the aftermath of the Second World War, carrying on with the century of the self. This is peak Curtis, by analogy, in the Curtis canon, probably this is bringing it all back home, which is seen as the start of the really golden streak for Bob Dylan. I'm trying to think of the Beatles analogy. It would be like Help, maybe, or Rubber Soul or something like that.
Yeah, it's more this kind of George Martin studio-based stuff, really, isn't it?
It's Revolver. Revolver.
Yeah.
This is Revolver.
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah. And as you said before the stream, it's absolutely evergreen. I was listening to the radio this week and William Clouston was on yesterday from the SDP. And he said, this is what happens when politicians ignore people's desires. I mean, that's literally the phrase from the Century of the Self last week where Stuart Ewan says, it's the idea of the people's desires being in charge. Can you think of another era when the elites in government cared about the people's desires, and isn't this the sea change of the 20th and 21st century that's led us to where we are, listening to people's desires?
I can't wait for the Adam Curtis documentary about this Starmer the Labour government. Oh. Where I mean, I can literally, I mean, I did a spoofful version of it the other day, you know, Parvini long for a return of sensible centrism, you know, the adults back in the room, yes. You know, moderate, technocratic, boring managerial government.
He was a man called Keir Starmer. He's almost completely forgotten today.
But this was a fantasy. But anyway, before we get going, I have to remind people, do buy courses at the Academic Agency. What is it, Simon? Promo code.
Scorcher.
Although the sun has now gone. It's the Academic Agency Summer Sale. Use the promo code SCORCHER. 25% off all courses. SCORCHER. Get it now. SCORCHER. 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 Promo code SCORCHER. 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 Buy it now. But then, 3,000 miles away.
What's the pow come from, by the way? I'm fascinated by that sound effect in that.
Let me just see it again. Hold on. Pow! It's a that is Tim Westwood. And it's it was a promo that he did for something in the late 90s when he was hosting the Radio 1 rap show. But he was on, like, I think it was when he presented Top of the Pops, and at the start of Top of the Pops, he goes "pow" like that. You know, I think it was that, although I can't actually remember the exact source. But
how the mighty have fallen.
I don't know what Westwood is up to now. So there we are.
Remand in Brixton.
All right. I mean, I think I'm pretty sure Ali G, the character, was based on Tim Westwood. Right. I think that was the. It was Ali G was meant to be a Mickey take of Tim Westwood, I'm pretty sure. Because if I remember correctly, Tim Westwood was like a reverend's son from like a sleepy little village in Kent or something.
Oh, the classic, I hated the sleepy, beautiful country village I lived in. So I to become more authentic, I had to do this.
Yeah. And then he started speaking with that kind of odd urban accent that he's got, you know. I mean, he'd be worth a deeper story in and of himself, Westwood. But anyway, let's make a start.
Let's say a word about dreams. We all have thoughts which we never knew we had. They are too uncomfortable, too incompatible with our adult self to be remembered. Yet they are often disturbing, rumbling under the surface like lava in a volcano. The dream is the royal road to these thoughts. The royal road to the unconscious.
This is the story of how Sigmund Freud's ideas about the unconscious mind were used by those in power in post-war America to try and control the masses. Politicians and planners came to believe that Freud was right to suggest that hidden deep within all human beings were dangerous and irrational desires and fears. They were convinced that it was the unleashing of these instincts that had led to the barbarism of Nazi Germany. To stop it ever happening again, they set out to find ways to control this hidden enemy within the human mind. At the heart of the story...
Particularly pertinent, Simon, this one today, don't you think?
Very much so.
You know, how the scourge has risen again. We must stamp it out, Simon, out of our society. It's no place in 2024 for, you know, far-right thugs to be back again on our streets.
I think it's a Boomer Truth Regime origin moment, this. This is where it all sort of comes together, you know. Big business, government, psychiatry. This is the laboratory in which the Boomer is spawned.
Yeah, really fascinating. If I ever come to write Boomer Truth Regime... How is it just not going to be distilled Curtis? Because he's basically already written it, hasn't he? In the form of his his life's work.
Yes, so. Yes.
Are Sigmund Freud's daughter Anna and his nephew Edward Bernays, who had invented the profession of public relations. Their ideas were used by the US government, big business, and the CIA to develop techniques to manage and control the minds of the American people. Those in power believed that the only way to make democracy work and create a stable society was to repress the savage barbarism that lurked just under the surface of normal American life.
Can we pause there just for a second? Just that footage you see of idyllic American suburbia of the 50s and 60s, I think and suspect some of that footage might be of Levittown, which was a development built between New York and the munitions plants on Long Island. And I think you mentioned it on a stream in the past, and I recommended that Ken Holling's book to you because he talks about Levittown. And it's interesting, he was talking in the narration about this acknowledgement of barbarism. And one of the interesting factoids about Levittown, it was built by a man, I think he was called Joseph Levitt. He was of a certain persuasion of Levantine origin. But he wrote into the deeds for Levittown that people, non-Caucasian people, could not settle there. Because he said, you can either have a solution to the housing problem, but you can't have you can't have the a solution to the race problem at the same time, which is an interesting observation. So black families were prohibited from essentially getting mortgages in Levittown. There's an interesting factor of the American dream there.
Very interesting. I mean, I think that is mentioned in that book I've got on suburbia.
Yeah.
Which led you to, maybe I did a stream on it. I'm trying to remember the author's name now.
Just that development of suburbia in itself is a fascinating part of this period in American history. This would just attempt to sort of have an organizing principle, but the one in which it was also kind of used as a laboratory for experimenting on the population.
Yeah, and I can't remember the name of that book now, but the thesis of that book that I am referring to, not the one that you recommended, which is also interesting. It's called The Geography of Nowhere. That's the title. Yes. And it's by, in fact, a guy who's still around. He's become like a Trumpian, this guy, which is somewhat surprising because he's a leftist. But now he seems to be, you know, he's kind of one of those. His name is James Howard Kunstler. Mm. And it's called The Rise and Decline of America's Man-Made Landscape, The Geography of Nowhere. And basically he says how the original conception of the suburban developments was basically to try to reproduce something that was akin to English villages, right? Or something like that, or, you know, a place where there's a community in the center and there was walking spaces and park spaces. And what he traces in that book is that the motor industry and the focus on the road and so on and on led basically to the destruction of that vision. And that the roads were widened and they made it like basically impossible to walk anywhere. So what started out as an attempt to create these little communities, in fact, ended up making these atomized spaces where nobody could really meet up and nobody could walk and needed a car to get anywhere. So it's kind of interesting.
Just to correct myself as well, it was William Levitt, not Joseph Levitt. But there's an interesting article, if you guys look up, The Times of Israel. It was called How America's Jewish King of the Suburbs Kept Blacks Out of Suburbia. And interestingly, there's a paragraph in there where it talks about he also built an upmarket community of modern housing on Long Island. And in that one, he actually also kept Jews out of it, which is interesting.
A guy called Levitt kept Jews. Okay.
Yeah. How does that work? I found the quote, "As a Jew, I have no room in my mind or heart for racial prejudice, but I have come to know that if we sell one house to a Negro family, that 90 or 95% of our white customers will not buy into the community. We can solve a housing problem or we can try to solve a racial problem, but we cannot combine the two." Talk about hard-nosed.
Very interesting. Well, there we go. For the anything for the green, eh? All about the Benjamins in America. So let's carry on.
The story begins in the middle of the fierce fighting of the Second World War. As the fighting intensified, the American army was faced by an extraordinary number of mental breakdowns among its troops. 49% of all soldiers evacuated from combat were sent back because they suffered from mental problems. In desperation, the army turned to the new ideas of psychoanalysis. They made a film record of the experiment using hidden cameras.
It says here on your record that you had headaches and that you had crying spells.
Yes, sir. I believe in your profession is called nostalgia.
In other words, homesickness.
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. It was induced when shortly before the war I received a picture of my sweetheart.
Yes.
I'm sorry, I can't continue.
That's all right.
It was the first time that anyone had paid such attention to the feelings and anxieties of ordinary people. At the heart of the experiment were a number of refugee psychoanalysts from Central Europe. They worked with American psychiatrists to guide and shape the project.
When I first came to America, I worked in the psychiatric service with soldiers trying to rehabilitate them. And I traveled in the train from the East Coast to the West Coast. I was enormously curious what goes on in all of those little towns that the train is passing. After my years in the army, I knew exactly what everybody was doing in the little towns.
I find it really interesting that Martin Bergman is kind of studying people in these little towns, almost as a scientist would study ants. Or an alien may study kind of human. He's clearly doing it from this objective third eye point of view. And I just find that a fascinating aspect of the psyche of people like Bergman.
Simon. It's a good observation, because actually in the footage that Curtis chooses later on, you see he does all these high camera looking down point of view shots onto masses of people in various flows. And you see them, you know, behaving like ants, like you say. So it's interesting factoid about this guy I also picked up. He used to do a bit of acting, and he actually was in he actually played an SS officer in Schindler's List. Floored you with that one. That's a bit
very interesting. I was just going back to his kind of, you know, long distance observation. I'm reminded of the opening spiel of, you know, War of the Worlds. You know, I think of the Richard Burton version, but, you know, minds immeasurably superior to our own.
Yes.
Watched us from space. You know, it's kind of like, it really does feel like that a little bit. Let's carry on.
Because I saw so many people who came from there, and I understood their aspirations, their disappointments, and so forth. So it was as if somebody invited me to a privileged tour into the inner soul of America.
I'm not doing this deliberately, so
of course
please believe
me. I do believe you. A display of emotion is sometimes very helpful.
Yeah, I hope so, sir.
Sure, it gets it off your chest.
Well, sir, to be perfectly honest with you, I'm very much in love with my sweetheart. She has been the one person that gave me a sense of importance in that through her cooperation with me, we were able to surmount so many obstacles.
Take it easy now. Just talk to you.
The psychoanalyst.
I mean, probably the most noteworthy thing about that soldier, Simon, is that he was married at all.
Yes.
Viewed from the point of view of today.
Yes. Yes, as I mean, this is one of Thomas Sowell's points, isn't it? The pre-war black family in America before the kind of, you know, the breakup that took place over the 60s and 70s was a you know, if you like, an integrated unit. This was kind of what a lot of the tussle culturally was in America about in the 60s, you know, integration or not. And one of the interesting factoids as well about you know, there was 1.4 million soldiers were treated for battle fatigue during World War II. I take it that's US soldiers. I didn't know there were that many. And 40% of medical discharges were for these kinds of PTSD conditions.
Yeah, it's kind of difficult to watch some of the footage, isn't it? I mean, Lord, no. I mean, this is the thing about Curtis. I mean, imagine how many hours of that he went through to pick out the little clips he's got. I mean, it's kind of... wonder what that does to a person to just watch through all of this extremely dark material.
Yes.
Use techniques developed by Freud to take the men back into their past. They became convinced that the breakdowns were not the direct result of fighting. The stress of combat had merely triggered old childhood memories. These were memories of the men's own violent feelings and desires, which they had repressed because they were too frightening.
Think deeply. Let's go back. When was it you...
To the psychoanalysts, it was overwhelming proof of Freud's theory that underneath, human beings were driven by primitive, irrational forces.
You want that?
Can we pause there for again? Sorry to the audience for pausing this, but this is a thing that somebody in the comments from last week picked me up on, and I just wanted to clarify. There was this model of the personality that Freud developed with these three parts, the id, the superego, and the ego. And when I discussed it last week, I very sort of consciously used a simplified model of that, where those parts correspond to the id is like the inner child, the superego is like the parent, and the ego is the adult, you know, us as the grown-up mature people making a kind of executive choice between them. And he took me up on the notion that I correlated the id with the child, because this is done in some forms of analysis, particularly transactional analysis. If you look up a man called Eric Byrne and a very interesting book called Games People Play, he uses that sort of lexicon to roughly match Freud's concept. But the id really is not just like a child, you know, it's not a gentle thing. It is what Curtis is talking about when he talks about the hidden violent and sexual forces within people. That is what the id is. It's the savage drives that inhabit everyone, and these are moralized at by your superego, which is what I corresponded with your inner parent, you know, the part of society that's telling you to manage yourself. And the ego, the adult, that's distinct from the parent. The adult is you as a fully self-actualized person who isn't a child, doesn't need a parent, and is, if you like, conducting those two forces and telling them to pipe down and, you know, be under your command. You know, those things are within you forever. You have your id is always there. Your superego is always there. But your ego is there to determine how you enact in the world. Mm. And this is what he's eliciting from this footage, this idea that the ultimate belief is that people, you know, it's a pessimistic belief that we are driven by essentially the id. And again, one thing that I heard this week was the psychologist talking on Talk TV, you know, one of those sort of, you know, accepted right of center channels. And she was talking about the riots at the moment, and she was talking about the dangerous people losing their identity with these riots. And really, she's not talking about identity in the way we talk about it. In terms of perhaps, you know, your national or your ethnic identity or anything like that. Really what she was saying is there's a fear that people are embracing their id, these savage forces within. And what you have to sort of realize is that that is emblematic of the way the bewildered herd that they talk about in this documentary is seen. It's a dangerous block of drives in individuals, which is expressed by the id. Okay, this primal instinctual force. And essentially, therefore, politics has to become a superego form. It has to become a parent, suppressing the id with moral restraint and propriety and moderation. Mm. And what you have then in this documentary, Curtis is essentially saying the danger of the psychiatric industry is that it comes along and it creates a kind of like a state of exception. So the crowd is always described as a potentially hostile force. You know, last week the Nazis were talked about in terms of they were bringing crowds of people together using libidinal forces. These are forces of in-group love. Mm. But noticeably, in our democracy, crowds are the id. They are Nazis in potentia. They're waiting to just break down, fragment, and unleash savagery. So the notion of psychological jeopardy that brings, it's annexed by the political class to justify the exception, like we talk about two-tier policing at the moment. The exceptions are made, and that remains in the background. So the operant assumption of political life is really that democracy can't exist as anything other than a managed psychiatric emergency. It can't be real because the actual agency, the crowd, cannot be permitted. So it has to be filtered by language, media, academia, etc. And so we see these these positions unrolling, whereby we mediate and manage the forces of irrationality. I just wanted to sort of clarify that.
Absolutely fascinating, Simon. I'm actually reminded of Paul Gottfried's concept of the therapeutic state.
Yes,
where he talks about a lot of related material. I'm also reminded, and I also wonder, like last night on Unpopular Opinions, and in fact on every stream I've done for the past, since this current situation started, I have told people, don't go, there's so many unknowns, it's completely unwise to get yourself involved in this. Everybody will have moved on in a couple of weeks. I mean, everybody's heard the spiel. I've done it a number of times. Mm. And every single time I've done that, there has been like a kind of vocal a number of people calling me everything, almost having like a child tantrum in the chat.
Yes.
And I'm thinking, like, are we replicating, I'm being the superego, certain trucks in the chat are being the id. Mm. And then the mediating force are those people in the chat saying, oh yes, wise words, AA, they're being the mediators. It's kind of a very interesting.
Yeah. I think you're probably being more like the ego, the fully self-actualized adult is making a choice between them. It's the government that is the parent, the superego, but it's only able to manage the id by these kind of moralistic injunctions. And as you say, the danger is we begin to enact part of these scenarios that are set up to fail, because the failure in itself is the way democracy works now. Like I use this phrase that I've come up with, this, it's a managed psychiatric emergency, and you're taking part in that.
Really interesting. So does that mean that when the government gives a Schmittian exception to certain kind of client groups, they basically just get those groups who get to act out, they are the ones who get to express their id, if you want to put it that way.
Selectively, by...
Yeah. Okay.
Democracy is the top line given of the situation. So the way you manage that is the sense of reality then has to be brought into line with that. So everything has to be kind of distorted in some way. So these people over here, they're writing for justifiable social and economic reasons. And things like, obviously racism comes up. These people over here, though, they're just writing because they're just evil. So that breakdown of mental order is supremely useful, because it has this sort of shape-shifting aspect, this chameleonic dangerous aspect, whereby the government is the ultimate arbiter as the parent. It's sometimes like the situation of discipline in the English mind, in the school ground, one kid hits another, but the teacher comes down and he whacks both of them. But sometimes
I do wonder if there are darker elements here. And again, I don't want to sound like a leftist here, Simon, saying that there's a unconscious bias or something. But the difference between the way the authorities respond to the native population and to client groups is almost like the difference between how you treat your own children and how you might treat adopted children, your own children actually are expected to behave. We don't do that in this household, blah, blah, blah.
Yes.
Whereas the ones the ones they care a little bit less about are basically indulged, spoiled, allowed to run riot, because actually they don't really care about those, or they feel like less. I mean, it's an odd thing to say. But I do actually wonder there is something to, we used to call it the bigotry of low expectations.
Yes.
But it's like they don't even try with some of those other groups. They don't even trust them or themselves to behave. It's like, we'll take it as a given that we can't control them. So let's concentrate on the ones that we can control.
Very much, actually. This may be too much information, but from a personal standpoint, my father was a bastard child. So essentially there was a sort of, a one night fling with some Irish guy by my grandmother, and my father was not therefore sort of in a sense connected to the rest of the family. And he was a very difficult and sometimes violent man. And the way he developed, my mother described, is they let him grow like a weed. He was just allowed off the hook all the time. you know, and it did develop in that sort of direction. So he didn't have any sense of accountability, or he didn't have any internalized moral parent, let's say, a superego. He would just act purely out of, you know, some, you know, his own id, let's say, you know.
It is actually a great failure of multiculturalism, if you think about it, though, because for all their talk of inclusivity and diversity and all of that, they never even try to, trust themselves to trust the out groups to actually be part of society properly.
Yes.
By treating them differently, by being like, okay, well, you know, we're going to have to be different with you guys because we actually know that you can't behave. You are actually the naughty kids.
Yes.
It's a very, very strange thing. But now that we talk about it, it makes perfect sense. All right, let's carry on.
World War II was a major shattering experience because I discovered the enormous role of the irrational in the lives of most people. Now that I can say, that I learned that, that the ratio between the irrational and the rational in America is very much in favor of the irrational. That there is much greater unhappiness, much more suffering, much more. A sadder country than one would imagine it from the advertisements that you get. A much more problematic country.
Victory in the Second World War was celebrated as a triumph of democracy. But in private, many policymakers were worried about the implications of the analysis of the soldiers.
I should mention, by the way, that I do question the claim of the irrationality of some of the enemies in World War II. I mean, if anything, there was a hyper-rationality in some of them. You know, I mean, the German disease, if the Germans have any problem at all in their psyche, is the doctrine of totality. It is actually taking the thing to its logical limits. Right. So if you I don't know, if you take a notion like eugenics, for example, okay, well, everybody understands those basic principles, but possibly only the Germans would go as far, you know, would be like, right, we really need to do it, you know.
A mechanistic drive for efficiency. Yeah.
Yeah. Or I mean, it's in Wagner, you know, the total music, total. And I mean, if anything, that is, I mean, viewed from one point of view, you could say it's irrationality. But viewed from another point of view, you could say, well, actually, it is the end point of logic. And that the British approach of bumbling through and kind of leaving certain things unsaid and ambiguous, and, you know, all the bits of the theory don't quite add up, is actually there is an irrationality in that.
Yes.
If you want to be strict about it.
But it's politically very flexible, as you say.
Yes. So pragmatism is not... pragmatism is actually inconsistent and irrational in a viewed from the lens of logical purity, whereas certain continental systems are actually more self-consistent. And in fact, many of the European doctrines, not just German ones, are total in that way. Austrian economics is a total system, a total rational system built up from axioms by Ludwig von Mises and other people. Julius Evola, viewed inside of his own system, is a perfectly rational, internally consistent system, as is like the entire body of Thomas Aquinas or something like that. And I think there's something in the Anglo mindset that bristles against that a little bit.
Yes.
We actually like our kind of woolly edges and, all right, yeah, maybe, but...
And it's made a virtue of, isn't it, in the, you know, we're messy and we're difficult and all these kinds of things, which are made, if you like, to sound as if they're allied with a kind of romantic kind of turn of mind. Not something that is necessarily aiming to be productive, you know. It's the journey, not the destination, man.
Yeah, but it also gives the ruling class, if you think about it, license basically to do anything they want.
Yes.
With ad hoc arguments, if you put it that way.
Well, this is the thing about, again, the recent riots, people saying about the police actions, you know, with the airport incident, if you remember. And, you know, the incident was that there was close contact with these guys who attacked the police. And there was a situation where one guy was tased, he was on the floor. And then, you know, one of the policemen then, you know, because the taser is only a temporary measure, it wears off. This other policeman noticed this guy on the floor and he stamps on his head. And I presume it was to stun him, basically, because the danger is in a situation like that, like we saw in Mannheim in July, someone gets behind your back, they can stick a knife in your neck. So, you know, in those sorts of situations. But people were saying, they were using justifications like saying, oh, well, the policeman did it just because he was angry, you know, mm-hmm. because police are only human. So it always has that sort of messiness in terms of justification, instead of, well, there's probably actually a pretty sound policing reason to deal with the situation in that way, because mm-hmm. the last guy who turned his back on someone is now dead.
Yeah. And I mean, it's the thing is, this kind of piecemeal ad hoc thing is flecked through the entire long history of the English common law, you know, the unwritten constitution. It's very unsystematic. And in fact, the only truly attempts at systematization that I can think of in English history, I mean, the Norman conquest, William the Conqueror was basically like almost like an autist trying to design a system.
Doing a massive audit in the Doomsday Book.
Yeah, I mean, that is, you know, an attempt of imposing continental order. But like fast forward 100 years and that's all gone to shit very quickly. You know, it's kind of, it doesn't stick to the original design and gets basically kind of won back by the peasantry, by the ancient freedoms of the peasantry. Mm. I'm trying to think of some other moments where, you know, I mean, Cromwell famously didn't last. Even the Glorious Revolution, you could argue that the original spirit of it doesn't really persist for that long, because around the corner you've got the age of the tycoons and the whole 19th century. So yeah. Anyway, let's carry on.
It seemed to show that underneath every American were irrational, violent drives. What had happened in Germany seemed to bear this out. The complicity of so many ordinary Germans in mass killings during the war showed just how easily these forces could break through and overwhelm democracy.
Planners and policymakers had been convinced by their experiences during World War II that...
Oh, sorry, I've triggered the history guys. When the Normans came, there was already a kind of criminal shire system. The country was divided into something called hundreds, with a constable and a sheriff, right? That actually predated the Normans, as far as I know. And he was like, right, we're going to keep that system, but we're also going to have, parallel to it, or with it within the same framework, we're also going to have the system of the baronies and the estates, with nobles landed titles attached to specific estates bestowed by the authority of the king. And then also parallel to that, there was the parish system of the churches. So there's three parallel systems that were meant to work in kind of harmony with a system of vague autonomy between the three different authorities: the authority of the church, the authority of the nobility, and then the civic authority of the sheriffs and the constables and the mayoral system. That was the original kind of William the Conqueror design, and the early Normans. But you can see how that develops and changes. You know, by the time you get to let's say Edward III, it's completely buggered. And in fact, they tried to do several resets. I think Edward I has a go at a reset. Edward III has a go at a reset. But then it goes to shit again with Richard II and the War of the Roses. So And by the time you get to the Tudors, it, you know, descends into quasi-absolutism and then actual absolutism with the Stuarts, and then you get the Civil War. So, you know, you could say, well, it worked for a while, but then it didn't work, you know. Anyway, let us not sidetrack ourselves too much.
Human beings could act very irrationally because of this sort of teeming and raw and unpredictable emotionality, the kind of chaos that lived at the base of human personality could, infect the society, social institutions, to such a point that the society itself would become sick. That's what they believe happened in Germany, in which the irrational, the anti-democratic, went wild. It was a vision of human nature as incredibly destructive, and they were terrified that Americans would in fact behave that way, or were capable of behaving that way, and they wanted to avoid a rerun of that.
So what is needed is a human being that can internalize democratic values so that they are not shaken with the storm.
Can you pause there?
Just a brief quote from Dr. Ewan Cameron, who is a figure who will come across later in the documentary. But just to echo the language that the lady was using there in terms of disease and illness with what happened in mid-century Germany, he says, Nazism could only occur when man had lost confidence in a design for living, which had seemed sufficient for decades. That's all.
And psychoanalysis carried in it the promise that it can be done. It opened up new vistas as to how the inner structure of the human being can be changed so that he becomes a more vital, free supporter and maintainer of democracy.
The psychoanalysts were convinced they not only understood these dangerous forces, but they knew how to control them too. They would use their techniques to create democratic individuals, because democracy left to itself failed to do this. The source of this idea was not only Sigmund Freud, but his youngest daughter, Anna. She had fled with her father to London before the outbreak of war. And after he died, Anna Freud became the acknowledged leader of the world psychoanalytic movement. She saw her job as to fulfill her father's dream of making his ideas accepted throughout the world.
At the center of the Freud movement stood Tante Anna, because she managed to work herself into that position. She was recognized as that, and not just because she was a daughter. She worked on that. She was rather forbidding. She was not, to me, a warm person, not an aunt you could kiss or put your arms around. Not at all.
Can't really blame her for that, given that her dad was Sigmund Freud. And you'd be pretty screwed up, wouldn't you?
Talking of the screw, do you know what happened to her? She was in therapy with Sigmund Freud from a very young age. And the reason was apparently that Freud was very concerned. I'm sorry, this is before the watershed and around tea time, but Freud was very concerned about her masturbation fantasies, which it is said were very frequent, violent, and masochistic. And she enjoyed what we call beating fantasies since about the age of six. So Freud was trying to sort of deal with this, apparently. She was screwed up.
And her whole life rotated around the spreading of psychoanalysis.
Freud himself had seen the role of psychoanalysis as allowing people to understand their unconscious drives. But Anna Freud believed it was possible to teach individuals how to control these inner forces. She had come to believe this through analysing children, above all the children of her close friend, Dorothy Burlingham. Dorothy Burlingham was an American millionairess who in the 1920s fled a failed marriage and brought her children to Anna Freud in Vienna. They were suffering terrible anxieties and aggression. But Anna Freud was convinced she could free them from this by changing the world around them.
she thought that she could come in and into their environment, essentially, because they were children, you see. They didn't have independent lives of their own. She could go talk to the parents or the mother. She could go to the schools. She could influence their real world, the actual external world, to change their lives and to help them.
And to change those people?
I think that was part of what her idea was, is that she felt that she could change them.
From her analysis of the Burlingham children, Anna Freud developed a theory of how to help them control their inner drives. She believed that if, as well as psychotherapy, they were also encouraged to adapt to a good family and social environment, then the conscious part of their mind, the ego, would be strengthened in its struggle to control the unconscious. Anna Freud's aim was simply to help the children. But it was always the psychoanalyst who decided what was the right environment and the appropriate behaviour for the children. And often as not, this reflected the social mores of the time.
In my father's case, they were concerned that he would be a homosexual. And so a lot of their efforts went into preventing or trying to stop my father from becoming a homosexual. Whether or not he would have or did, or, you know, it's unknown to me.
Why did they want to stop him?
Because they felt it was abnormal. It wasn't a normal way to develop. They wanted to have him develop along lines that society recognized to be normal, because if they didn't, then you're going to be under the control of forces that you don't understand, that you're not even aware of.
Now of course, it's the complete reverse of that. Why aren't you gay?
Indeed, if you look at the Anna Freud organization, is still there, annafreud.org. There's an interesting question here. I looked for information about why Robert Burlingham was being investigated about concerns he might be homosexual from a therapy point of view, and it's not really out there. It's not really clear. But what is interesting was that Anna Freud herself ended up living with Dorothy Burlingham in effectively what was a lesbian relationship. So why she would be concerned about him being sort of atypical is interesting. And I found quite an interesting blog from a chap who was interested in Anna Freud, a man called Robert Whiston, who wrote an interesting passage about Anna Freud. And he says, Anna Freud and the school of thought that gathered around her maintained that any post-divorce contact between parents was inherently confrontational, dangerous, and or violent. Awarding sole custody to mothers achieved the twin ambitions of limiting a father's access to his children and restricting any dangerous confrontational scenes with his former wife. So there's a suggestion she was somewhat perhaps damaged by her experiences with Freud and conflicted about the role of the father. And if you look at the Anna Freud organization, they have something called a manifesto, which is, it's all a kind of completely DEI inflected organization, aims are thought of in let me see, where does it say what their aims are, but it was essentially we're here to help the kids, but what you look at when you look at their manifesto, the word father is not mentioned once when they're talking about the sort of the problems of children in the modern world, and the word family doesn't occur either. So there seems to be a strong impetus in Anna Freud's work to
the absolute irony, Simon, Freud's daughter would try to kill the father.
Well, isn't it interesting? That's all I'm saying.
The analysis seemed to be a great success, and in the 30s, the Burlingham children had returned to America. They settled down to happy married lives in the suburbs. What they didn't realise was that their experience was about to become a template for a giant social experiment to control the inner mental life of the American population. In 1946, President Truman signed the National Mental Health Act. It had been born directly out of the wartime discoveries by psychoanalysts that millions of Americans who had been drafted suffered hidden anxieties and fears. The aim of the act was to deal with this invisible threat to society.
Shocked by the appalling percentage of the emotionally unstable revealed by the World War II draft figures, Congress in 1946 passed the National Mental Health Act, which recognized for the first time that mental illness was a national problem. Keenly aware of the tremendous problems ahead is Dr. Robert H. Felix, director of the vast new project.
A primary objective of the National Mental Health Program is to increase our fund of scientific knowledge about mental health and about mental illness. We're not doing this. Why? Because there are all too few skilled mental health workers.
Two of the principal architects of the Act were the Menninger brothers, Carl and Will. Will had run the wartime psychotherapy experiments, and now he and his brother began to train hundreds of new psychiatrists. The Menningers were convinced that it would be possible to apply Anna Freud's ideas on a wide scale, and to adults as well as children. The psychiatrist's job would be to teach ordinary Americans how to control their unconscious drives. Psychoanalysis could be used to make a better society.
They said psychoanalytic thinking could make for the betterment of society because you could change the way the mind functioned. And you could take the ways in which people did hurtful things to themselves and others and alter them by enlarging their understanding. And this was the vision psychoanalysis brought.
That you could really change people.
That you could really change people. And you could change them almost in limitless ways.
You know, one of the darkest realizations I've come to, Simon, and it's one that I still don't really want to admit, but I have to admit the possibility that it's possible, right? I had always held to the view that what he just said was wrong and that human nature was actually fixed and unchangeable. But I think that quite a lot of evidence is in. And while they will never be able to change, you know, the core of human nature, if you want to put it that way, there's some pretty great elasticity in there, I reckon. And I mean, you just have to see the, let's say, for example, the rise of LGBT in the past 10 years. Now, if that was a purely natural phenomenon, that figure should always be static. And yet tweak a few incentives here and there, and you can make the number go up or down. I just find that very interesting indeed.
Yes.
And terrifying.
Yes, and well, it's probably right to feel that, because I mean, what you're seeing here, and I think this is the thing to emphasize again, is it's using psychiatry and the exploration of the mental wellness of the individual as the frame in which democracy is carried out, as I said, as this managed, you know, psychiatric emergency. So the vision of the human that's being looked at is this savage id. It's a very limited and narrow, in a sense, part of the personality, but it's one in which there is great malleability, because it is playing to all these various desires that we see later on in next week. There becomes a whole lifestyle culture generated out of satisfying these desires, so that, you know, you do have plenty. We'll see in later in this documentary, the corporations realize there's plenty to play with within that ambit. And so the things that you're talking about in the id that are to do with vulnerability, pain, suffering, you know, appetite, desire, are all the things that are being entertained by the present culture of victimhood, kind of and grievance collection, and vulnerability and being wounded and damaged in some way. So it's a great playground, but it is only a selected part of the personality. The ego, the adult, is not entertained anymore, because that power has been devolved upwards to the parent, the government.
Yeah, well, I mean, as you know, Mrs. AA has been studying a lot of this stuff over the past few years, and every once in a while I have to read something, you know, whether it's from psychoanalysis or one of the other schools of therapy that she's been, because there are lots of different ones, you know. One of the things that I really don't like is the emphasis on trauma, Simon.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Now, so many of the studies come from these men that we're seeing here, right? Literally these men, i.e. people who've got PTSD after World War II, or in some cases it's Vietnam, it's usually guys who've been to the army who suffer trauma, right? Because they've been to a literal war zone, and they've come and they've come back shaken, right?
Yes.
And, and what they do is they transfer those ideas to something as simple as, I don't know, a raised voice in the house.
Yes.
Oh no, a child has heard their dad raise their voice, and that's traumatic. Now that's trauma. Now.
Yes.
And it's like you're literally equating a guy who has watched people being blown up and, you know, dodged a bomb or had to kill somebody to somebody shouting. It's not the same thing.
That's the thing that Curtis says early on. He says that, you know, the psychiatrists felt that this was essentially, it's an odd disjunction, as you say, because they've come from a war zone, but the psychiatrists are relating it to these are sort of repressed experiences from their childhood that are kind of bubbling up. This is the suppressed id that's coming out. But as you say, a war zone is horrific. Anybody who's looked at, you know, drone footage from Ukraine recently can attest to that. And, you know, when they used to talk about PTSD, of course, they originally framed it as something like shell shock, you know. You know, just to give a small example from my own experience, I went a few years ago to the Military Defence College at Shrivenham on a day out with some ex-special forces people, old blokes in their 60s, and they gave us some explosive and showed us how to set up an explosive charge, right? And they gave me what was like a sort of Kit Kat-sized piece of plastic explosive, and you tamp it into a copper cone, and then that gets attached to a piece of steel plate about an inch thick, and then there's a detonator thing put in it, and they put it into a blast shed, like a big tough building, to set this thing off. And so we're all standing around outside, and they set this charge off. Now, this was a small explosive charge. It was a horrific sound. The ground shook. This wasn't like a firework going off. This was something that you felt in its power could tear bodies apart, and this was just a small one. And if you're talking about shell shock, you know, in the context of war, if you're getting things like that happening all around you, you don't need to worry about your repressed childhood memories in order to go insane. that would destroy you psychologically on its own. You know, it's very difficult to describe the difference, but I've never been in a war zone. That's the closest I've come. But that was, you know, that was terrifying in a weird way.
Seemingly you were told off a few times when you were a kid, and that didn't leave you shell shocked, right? I mean, it's just like kind of, because you get really bizarre things developing from it. Like, there's a whole thing called gentle parenting, which is it's absolute bollocks, but it's literally taking this idea to the nth degree, where any little thing can, be said to induce trauma, you know, lasting damage is another one of the terms.
Well, that's the thing you get actually in the performance world, the acting world. You go to a drama school in somewhere like America, where they're very sort of into an intense kind of method-based training, and they basically have this model of breaking students down psychologically and then building them back up again. And it is almost like a psychotherapeutic model. And they'll say things to students, you know, in order to find the energy for your performance, they'll say things like, find your damage and use your damage as your motor for your creativity. It's explicitly, it's very dark, but it's the way it's explicitly linked. And what you said there about gentle parenting, a lot of the stuff about Anna Freud and her, you know, this guy on this blog, he was saying the lingering question has to be, why was Anna Freud so opposed to fathers participating in their children's lives? And in Norway in the 1990s, something was developed called the new father model. It's a little tricky to get a handle on this, because probably the primary literature, a lot of it's going to be in Norwegian. But it was this idea that there was the traditional fathers who were sort of like your character? What's the chap with the slippers that are brought to him at 6 o'clock exactly?
George Banks. Yes.
You know, so he's the traditional father. But the new father model is one of these sort of, it's a bit like the sensitive new age man was, you know, in the kind of 80s and 90s. He shares responsibility for the kids, and he's more strongly emotionally attached. And this became the sort of de rigueur kind of way of looking at fatherhood at the time. It was, you know, the papoose slings and all of the stuff that fathers, you know, get, you know, trammeled with these days, as I'm sure you know all too well. But this became, if you like, sort of embedded in the sort of currency of contemporary child rearing. And the opposition to that was either the traditional model of if you like, somewhat sort of mildly disinterested but protective fatherhood, and the kind of hyper-masculine model, I suppose, of you know, a kind of, you know, off the rails Andrew Tate kind of figure, the terrible father, you know what I mean? But then it was this thing, the new father model, which was very much adopted in the Scandinavian countries. And that's probably contributed an awful lot to what you're talking about there.
Yeah, horrible over-feminization of everything, really.
That's correct, yes.
And I, in fact, it's funny because I was sent something today, an article from Psychology Today, basically saying that every single faddish model of parenting, including gentle parenting and all the other ones, are all basically bollocks. And there are just three fundamental principles of parenting that you can boil down to what needs to be done. I even am a bit more radical, Simon. I actually think parenting is altogether overrated as a thing.
Yes.
And I remember reading a book by Judith Harris, I think her name was.
Yes.
About nurture and nature, and basically said, like, well, what she did, she took all these twins who were adopted in different parts of the world, and they ended up like with the same sort of job, same sort of taste, same sort of, you know, even in some cases, dress sense, earning potential, grades in school. And it was like, well, they are completely different parents, not necessarily the same sort of background. I remember reading before that you can predict by how many books your parents have on the shelves, academic performance, but whether the child is read to by those parents or not makes no difference whatsoever. It is simply your parents are the sort of people who are going to do that, which means they're more likely to be high IQ, which means you're more likely to be high IQ, which means, therefore, you have more natural ability. And of course, all of those things are discouraged in this kind of side of things, which massively leans on the kind of nurture side or Lockean blank slateism, basically.
Yeah. So,
anyway, let's carry on. Let's carry on.
In the late 40s, a vast project began in America to apply the ideas of psychoanalysis to the masses. Psychological guidance centres were set up in hundreds of towns. They were staffed by psychiatrists who believed it was their job to control the hidden forces inside the minds of millions of ordinary Americans.
Yes, I need something done. I need some help.
Did you have any particular teachers that you liked?
I liked all my teachers except one, I remember.
What was the trouble with this one?
I don't know. She just scared me most of the time. She'd holler at me and I'd run outside and vomit.
I hate my brother. Loathe him. Despise him.
At the same time, thousands of counselors were trained to apply psychoanalysis to marriage guidance. And social workers were sent out to visit people's homes and advise on the psychological structure of family life. Behind all this was the fundamental idea of Anna Freud's, that if people were encouraged to conform to the accepted patterns of family and social life, then their ego would be strengthened. They would be able to control the dangerous forces within them.
When your emotions control your actions, it affects not only yourself, but the people around you. And if this sort of flare-up is repeated often, it might lead to a permanently warped personality. You can control the fire of your emotions so that your personality becomes more pleasant.
You see, I find myself on, because there's not a large leap from that to stoicism, Simon.
Yeah.
And I have always been on the side of controlling the emotions through stoical methods and various other ways.
Yeah.
But it seems like since this time, the emphasis has very much been, especially in this country, since something like the death of Princess Diana. And I see it as a frankly rank American influence of actually displaying your emotions, of actually being more in touch with them, of, externalizing them, to use that kind of acting phrase. Yes. And I wonder where that, I wonder when exactly that flipped around from this messaging of controlling your emotions to that messaging of actually let it all hang out, Jerry, Jerry.
Yeah. I mean, that Diana moment was certainly one of the big cultural inflections that I think divide a lot of people in the way that other issues have divided people in more recent years as to those who get it and those who don't. That Diana moment with the hysteria and the soft toys being left at Kensington Palace was one of those things that left me baffled, that hyper-emotionalism, that, you know, the fact is, you know, we didn't know this woman, you know, you didn't have any connection. It's that's kind of related to some schools of psychoanalysis like Eric Byrne that I talked about earlier, transactional analysis, whereby people experience emotions that are not their own emotions. He calls them racket emotions, like as in a protection racket. They're emotions that keep you at a distance from actually resolving your own psychological problems. And that felt like one of those moments where, and of course, Tony Blair weaponized it magnificently to create a complete distraction from the issues of people's actual lives, was to focus and connect with someone who they had absolutely no hope of connecting with or understanding, and having this, if you like, this proxy for an experience. As I think I think Gore Vidal famously said at the time, you know, we were not crying for Diana, we were crying for ourselves.
I mean I remember that whole thing vividly. It was a very odd day, very odd.
You were either part of it or you weren't. And I think lots of us were just baffled and looking, well, I won't say lots of us, probably the 1% of the 1% were not taken in.
Yeah. I was one of the very first people who must have heard about it, because I was listening to talk radio as I did when it broke in like 3 a.m. or whatever. And I went and woke my mum up, said, oh, Princess Diana's died. She was like, what? Shut up. Go back to bed or whatever. She was like, she didn't believe me initially. But then I remember I was in school at the time, and it was a very odd day. It really was. There was a kind of hush around the place. It was.
Yeah. You almost thought, even when Blair appeared on the telly, it was almost like he was slightly caught off guard by it. Slightly sort of, you thinking, you could see in his eyes, maybe there's something of, am I really going to get away with this? You know? But, you know, you may recall when we saw the Blair musical and we had Mandelson telling him to shape the grief.
Shape the grief, yeah.
So we expect that someone who's been through that experience to be much more insightful, much more understanding, and a much better regulated person.
And what happens to the guy?
And regulation includes being able to let go, as it were, to enjoy a football game or a soccer game. A more understanding, yes, rational, but also appropriately emotional person. The regulatory aspects of the human mind would really be in charge.
So, sorry to pause again, Simon. I'm pretty sure that's the second time Curtis has used that music. He used that music before, didn't he? I'm trying to remember exactly when.
Yes. He does use his repeat bits, and he repeats bits of footage as well. I was just saying, some of that American footage from the 50s reminds me very much of the stuff you used in your Boomer Truth Regime video, you know, talking about the kid at school who's scratched the desk and the principal calls him in and says, what are you going to do to fix this situation? And the whole thing is a kind of a parable for him, to learn from, about how to control his id.
It may even be the exact same film. It was called something like, about your inner child, or don't let your inner child out, or something like that. I can't remember.
Mastering your moods or something. Yeah, that kind of stuff.
And in fact, yeah, I think it's that exact clip with that little clip of music. I think that is in the Boomer Truth, one of the Boomer Truth Regime films I made back in the day. Heavily inspired by Curtis, of course, so it all comes full circle. Act your age, that's it. Act your age. Well done.
That's it, yeah.
Instead of
being overwhelmed by our passions and by our darker impulses, that one would be master or mistress of one's own passions.
They just felt that the road to happiness was in adapting to the external world in which they lived, that people could be uncrippled from their own neurotic conflicts and impulses, that they would not engage in self-destructive behavior, that they would, in fact, adapt to the reality about them. They never questioned the reality. They never questioned that it might itself be a source of evil or something to which you could not adapt. without compromise or without suffering or without exploiting yourself in some way. So there was this fit with the politics of the day.
And a balance of emotions is important to a well-rounded personality.
But it was only the beginning of the rise to power of psychoanalysis in America. Psychoanalysts were about to move into big business and use their techniques not just to create model citizens, but model consumers. Last week's episode showed how Freud's American nephew, Edward Bernays, had been the first to convince American corporations that they could sell products by connecting them with people's unconscious feelings. But now, a group of psychoanalysts were going to take what Bernays had begun and invent a whole range of techniques to get inside and manage the unconscious mind of the consumer. They were led by Ernest Dichter. Dichter had practiced next door to Freud in Vienna, but he had come to America and set up the Institute for Motivational Research in an old mansion north of New York.
This is the Institute for Motivational Research, a place devoted to the intriguing business of finding out why people behave as they do, why they buy as they do, why they respond to advertising as they do. And this is Dr. Ernest Dichter.
We don't go out and ask directly, why do you buy, why don't you? What we try to do instead is to understand the total personality, the self-image of the customer. We use all the resources of modern social sciences. It opens up some stimulating psychological techniques for selling any new product.
Like the other psychoanalysts, Dichter believed that American citizens were fundamentally irrational beings. They could not be trusted. Their real reasons for buying products were rooted in unconscious desires and feelings. And Dichter wanted to find ways to uncover what he called the secret self of the American consumer.
He was trying to get out of people's mind the unconscious motivations that they had for purchasing. These could be sexual, they could be psychological, they could be sociological, they could be a demand for status, a demand for recognition. There were things that people couldn't verbalize or wouldn't verbalize because they were too secret to them. They were too much a part of their nature, and they would be embarrassed. They would be embarrassed if they came out and said things like this.
He would interview people, but not ask them direct questions, but let them talk freely like you do in psychoanalysis. And that was his background.
And so he said, why can't we have a group therapy session about products? All right? And so Dichter built this room up above his garage, and he said, we can have psychoanalysis of products. They can actually act out and verbalize their wants and needs.
What we're going to do is try a couple of these salad dressings.
Now Simon, sorry to pause this, but I mean, I can't help but notice that a lot of these people are from a similar sort of background. And
purely coincidental.
I mean, it's getting to be a theme in Curtis. I just wonder if that is a conscious or unconscious on his part, or whether that is actually just the story of what happened in this post-war moment. Because now going back to my War of the Worlds analogy, I mean, it really does seem like a kind of, you know, there's a big distance between the general populace and this small closed group of experts, you know? Interesting.
Yeah.
Let's see what happens. Here is our typical housewife. She doesn't follow the instructions.
And they could be observed and watched, and other people could comment, and they could talk about it, and everybody could join in. He was the first to do this. This was absolutely the first thing that was ever done. And he had a movie projector up there where you could show advertisements and things like that, and people could react to them. And he invented the whole technique for mining the unconscious about the hidden psychological wants that people had about products. This became the focus group.
It worked!
Dichter's breakthrough came with a focus group study he did for Betty Crocker Foods. Like many food manufacturers in the early 50s, they had invented a new range of instant convenience foods. But although consumers had told market researchers they would welcome the idea, in fact, they were refusing to buy them. The worst problem was the Betty Crocker cake mix. Dicta did a series of focus groups where housewives free associated about the cake mix. He concluded that they felt unconscious guilt at the new image being promoted of ease and convenience.
In other words, he understood that the barrier to the consumption of the product was the housewife's feeling of guilt about you.
It's just getting ridiculous. I wonder where Bill Schlackman is from.
It's a brilliant story, though, this concept that he's going to explain about how to sell the cake mix. It's great.
Yeah, very interesting. And you see, this is something that is talked about when it comes to some of these people, the advertisers, let's just say this class of people that we're focusing on here, merchant class, is not taking no for an answer. Mm. Oh, the public's not going for it. Oh, let's give up there. No. Let's change their dreams. Let's try to get over what it is that's stopping them. There is a kind of art to it of not, I remember reading once about how the public didn't take to jazz initially in the 1920s.
Yeah.
And yet they carried on trying. And what they managed to do in the 1920s is book prestigious venues where they put on Mozart concerts and things like that, which had high status.
Yeah.
And they put the jazz venue, they put the jazz on there. And then it was like, oh, it's at the Carnegie Hall, is it? Or it's at the, and it's like, oh, right. So then they made it desirable by being a high society thing. And then people convinced themselves that they like jazz, even though initially the public were completely turned off by it.
That aggressive, ABC, always be closing mindset, coffee's for closers.
Yeah, closers only.
Using it. They basically, on one hand, wanted to make it easy for themselves, but they felt guilty about it. So what you've got to do in those circumstances is remove the barrier being guilt. The way you do that is to give the housewife a greater sense of participation.
And how do you do that?
By adding an egg.
Simple as that.
Dicta told Betty Crocker to put an instruction on the packet that the housewife should add an egg. It would be an unconscious symbol, he said, of the housewife mixing in her own eggs as a gift to her husband, and so would lessen the guilt. Betty Crocker did it, and the sales soared.
My goodness,
genius.
We should perhaps get our friend Oliver on to talk about the power of symbology in advertising, because it's something we can tend to look askance at and think, well, it's left to the realms of the conspiracy world to talk about symbols in things, these kind of nudges and hints. But there is, like we were saying last week, there's something there that seems to have had a correlation with increased sales. Let's say there's something in these crazy theories of Freud.
Simon, even this though. In the eternal law of entropy has degenerated, because the egg in the Betty Crocker has degenerated to the little soy packet in the pot noodle.
Yes. Yes, add the magic spice.
Cake is ready.
The consumer may have basic needs that the consumer himself or herself doesn't fully understand. You have to know what those needs are in order to fully exploit the consumer. Is it wrong to give people what they want by taking away their defenses, helping remove their defenses?
It seems so much longer than
that's so dark.
I mean, that kitchen, I know that's from a clip. I think Mr. D has talked about that or played that on a previous show somewhere. It's an extended sort of clip about a woman. She's dancing around in a kind of an ideal future. And I know Curtis uses other bits from that clip, from that film. But that kitchen was very interesting, the way that cake pops up out of that sort of that little glass dome. It's like a sort of technocratic birthing module of some kind, that this suggestion the kitchen becomes a kind of surrogate for all of, literally a surrogate in some ways for all of these things that women feel kind of encumbered to do, like giving birth and, you know, making food and all this sort of stuff that's sold to us as the labor saving device. That's the world of the future. Just an interesting.
That line, by the way, about taking your defense mechanisms away in order to give people what they really want. The economic flip side of it is libertarianism. I can imagine Milton Friedman, Murray Rothbard, Ludwig von Mises also using, what's the problem if they really want it? Because that is basically the justification for libertarianism. So it's interesting how the economic doctrine and these sorts of psychological arguments actually go together. Yes. And then as soon as you see a problem with it, you want to institute a control against it. And that makes you a socialist, you see, Simon.
Well, I was thinking about this. Libertarianism seems to be very much an attempt to formulate a kind of ideology of the ego. That's to say the adult. Do you know what I mean? It's, you know, I make my choices. I'm always in control, you know. But the problem with it comes because it's a very isolated form of adult. You know, it has all the kind of freedoms to choose. It perhaps doesn't necessarily question if that individuality fits into a vision of collective harmony in society. I mean, I'm going to upset libertarians possibly, but I think that's, in a way, it's a kind of manageable form of ego that's allowed into the public space because perhaps it goes to excess and it troubles and creates anxiety for all of the little superegos that are wandering around, the parental voices in people's heads saying, oh, that's a bit too much freedom, you know. But you know, the libertarians make a point of it, and in a way they're expressing a form of adult, but one which never kind of gets to launch in our society because it's undermined by the moralistic voices of government and, you know, the parent in people's heads telling you can't have that much control, that would be too much.
You see the thing is that, you know, like my old friend Base Liz, for example, who's like super libertarian. They always assume the frame where the individual consumer is kind of sovereign and has the fact at their disposal, and therefore, because they're adults, they can make an informed choice.
Yes,
but let's face it, Simon. Most people are total dribbling morons, and so they need to be protected against some of these demons that we're seeing in this stream.
Absolutely, this is a contentious assumption that's made that you know of whether the person is a rational participant in society, a rational consumer, and obviously, you know, Bernays thought differently, and here we are.
I've become very paternalistic.
Yes.
It's like society needs to be controlled and almost like children, the swarming masses need to have protections against them. Otherwise they'll be swindled by people using dark psychological tricks. Anyway, let's carry on.
Go on.
Last year.
It is. Nearly 4 inches longer in some models.
Oh.
Dicta's success led to a rush by corporations and advertising agencies to employ psychoanalysts. They became known as the Depth Boys, and they promised to show companies how to make millions by connecting their products with people's hidden desires. Dicta himself became a millionaire, famous for inventing slogans like "A tiger in your tank." Even the marketing of the Barbie doll came from a children's focus group.
And so it goes.
But Dicta was convinced that this was far more than just selling. Like Anna Freud, he believed that the environment could be used to strengthen the human personality. And products have the power both to sate inner desires and give people a feeling of common identity with those around them. It was a strategy for creating a stable society. Dicta called it the strategy of desire.
To understand a stable citizen, you have to know that modern man quite often tries to work off his frustrations by spending on self-gratification. Modern man is eternally ready to fill out his self-image by purchasing products which complement it.
If you identify yourself with a product, it can have a therapeutic value. It improves your self-image and you become a more secure person, and you have suddenly this confidence of going out in the world and doing what you want successfully.
Listen, we all saw the sign, chat, calm down. Bloody hell, it's like being at a griper convention here. You know, act your age.
And it's believed that that would then improve the whole of our society and become the best society on this planet.
By the early 50s, the ideas of psychoanalysis had penetrated deep into American life. The psychoanalysts themselves became rich and powerful. Many had consulting rooms overlooking Central Park in New York. Politicians and famous writers like Arthur Miller and Tennessee Williams became their patients. They were seeking not just help, but to understand the hidden roots of human behavior.
We were sought after. Washington was interested in what we think. You know, the important writers, important politicians were undergoing psychoanalysis. It was, we had waiting lists because there were so many patients that wanted to be analyzed. So it gave us a little bit of a swellhead.
And as the psychoanalyst's ideas took hold in America, a new elite began to emerge in politics, social planning, and in business.
Where is Curtis going with this? Mm. He is getting, like, he walks right up. All of these people from Brooklyn, New York, are a new elite in America.
What linked this elite was the assumption that the masses were fundamentally irrational. To make a free market democracy like America work, one had to use psychological techniques to control mass irrationality.
They actually believed that this elite was necessary because individual citizens were not capable, if left alone, of being democratic citizens. The elite was necessary in order to create the conditions that would produce individuals capable of behaving as a good consumer and also behaving as a democratic citizen. They didn't see their activities as anti-democratic, as undermining the capacity of individual citizens for democracy, quite the opposite. They understood that they were creating the conditions for democracy's survival and future.
Anna Freud had never intended that her ideas be used in such a way, but she happily accepted the rise to power of psychoanalysis in America. She remained in England, living with Dorothy Burlingham. On the surface, it was an idyllic life. She and Dorothy had bought a weekend cottage on the Suffolk coast. And in the summers, Dorothy's children came from America to visit with the grandchildren. But underneath, things were going badly wrong. Both Bob and Mabby Burlingham, who Anna Freud had analysed in the 1930s, had suffered personal breakdowns, and their marriages were collapsing. Bob was drinking heavily, and Mabby suffered terrible anxieties. The real reasons for the visits to England were yet more analysis with Anna Freud.
Well, the problem was that it didn't look very good, did it? Because here you have somebody who's having nervous breakdowns and is having alcoholic binges. And this is not exactly, doesn't really sit well. You know, from a humane standpoint, obviously this is not desirable. You know, you want to help these people, but it also had the wider ramifications of everybody in analysis, in analytic circles, knew that Bob and Mabby were guinea pigs. They were the living proof that this was a wonderful process. It was very much swept under the rug. It really didn't get out. I mean, these people had such, their power and influence was such that, you know, you were very careful. Anna Freud was a very powerful person.
Surely that's a canard. Surely that's a canard. And anyway, let's carry on.
And you were the grandchildren, and she knew a great deal more than you did about what went on in your parents' lives and so forth. It was not something you were going to tangle with, and you were a product of the whole situation. But at the same time,
Can't help think, by the way, of John Stuart Mill, Simon, who was also one of these kind of real life experiments, wasn't he? They had this experiment, you know, give me the child at seven and I'll show you the man. John Stuart Mill's father was James Mill, who was a philosopher and a utilitarian. And they essentially used John Stuart Mill as a real life experiment. You know, we'll make this, we're going to make this young boy a world famous philosopher. And obviously he did become a world famous philosopher, but also John Stuart Mill was famously, you know, not a normal person. I'll just put it that way. So, yeah. So anyway, let's carry on.
And we all knew that something was really out of whack.
As she grew older, she became more and more important, didn't she? Politically and scientifically, but she didn't know when to stop. She was a bit too righteous. What she did was always the thing, and she would never, to my knowledge, acknowledge that she could make a mistake or be wrong. That is my feeling.
But the power and influence of the Freud family in America was about to grow even more. Politicians were about to turn to Anna Freud's cousin, Edward Bernays, for help in a time of crisis. He was going to manipulate the inner feelings and fears of the masses to help America's politicians fight the Cold War.
I don't mean to say, and no one can say to you, that there are no dangers. Of course there are risks if we are not vigilant, but we do not have to be hysterical.
In 1953, the Soviet Union exploded its first hydrogen bomb, and the fear of nuclear war and communism gripped the United States. Those in power became concerned about how to reassure the population. Committees were set up and public information films made, appealing for calm in the face of new threats, like nuclear fallout.
It's the fallacy of devoting 85% of one's worrying capacity to an agent that constitutes only about 15% of an atomic bomb's destroying potential.
At this point, Edward Bernays was living in New York. In the 1920s, he had invented the profession of public relations.
I love that Bernays gets the long doom, hands him a note.
Yeah.
You know, Bernays.
Dark Lord of his day.
Yeah. Dark Lord, yeah.
And was now one of the most powerful PR men in America. He worked for most of the major corporations and advised politicians, including President Eisenhower. Like his uncle Sigmund, Bernays was convinced that human beings were driven by irrational forces. The only way to deal with the public was to connect with their unconscious desires and fears. Bernays argued that instead of trying to reduce people's fear of communism, one should actually encourage and manipulate the fear, but in such a way as it became a weapon in the Cold War. Rational argument was fruitless.
What my father understood about groups is that they are manipulable, they're malleable, and that you can tap into their deepest desires or their deepest fears and use that to your own purposes. I don't think he felt that all those publics out there had reliable judgment, that they very easily might vote for the wrong man or want the wrong thing, so that they had to be guided from above.
One of Bernays's main clients was the giant United Fruit Company. They owned vast banana plantations in Guatemala in Central America. For decades, United Fruit had controlled the country through pliable dictators. It was known as a banana republic. But in 1950, a young officer, Colonel Arbenz, was elected president. He promised to remove United Fruit's control over the country.
I didn't know that was the origin of Banana Republic, was United Fruit running Guatemala. Interesting.
It's one of the first CIA coups.
Very interesting.
And in 1953, he announced the government would take over much of their land. It was a massively popular move, but a disaster for United Fruit. And they turned to Bernays to help get rid of Arbenz.
United Fruit brings in Bernays, and he basically understood that what United Fruit Company had to do was change this from being a popularly elected government that was doing some things that were good for the people there into this being very close to the American shore, a threat to American democracy, that it being at a time in the Cold War when Americans responded to issues of the Red Scare and what communism might do, he was trying to transform this and brilliantly did transform it into an issue of a communist threat very close to our shores, taking United Fruit again as a commercial client out of the picture and making it look like a question of American democracy, American values being threatened.
Do you think, Simon, that because of the problem of elite degeneration, that one of the reasons that they keep on going back to the same playbooks over and over again is that there just are no men like Benet's left anymore? So they just have to go back to the same ideas that they have done a million times.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the exact same playbook over and over and over and over again.
Yes.
When it comes to America's enemies, you know.
I suspect so.
In reality, Arbenz was a democratic socialist with no links to Moscow. But Bernays set out to turn him into a communist threat to America. He organized a trip to Guatemala for influential American journalists. Few of them knew anything about the country or its politics. Bernays arranged for them to be entertained and to meet selected Guatemalan politicians who told them that Arbenz was a communist controlled by Moscow. During the trip, there was also a violent anti-American demonstration in the capital. Many of those who worked for United Fruit were convinced it had been organized by Bernays himself.
Isn't that interesting, Simon? I wonder if governments ever get the idea that they run their enemies' riots for them. I wonder.
This whole section reminds me, if you know the bit in Godfather 2, where there's the sort of the revolution in Cuba, just the atmospherics of it, you know, the way it kind of just unravels so quickly and with such, you know, seemingly out of nowhereness.
Great sequence, by the way, though. Great sequence. That's what one of the few acting roles of Lee Strasberg, isn't it? Plays Hyman.
Yes, that movie, that's right. Yeah.
He also created a fake independent news agency in America called the Middle American Information Bureau. It bombarded the American media with press releases saying that Moscow was planning to use Guatemala as a beachhead to attack America. All of this had the desired effect.
In Guatemala, the Jacob Arbenz regime became increasingly communistic after its inauguration in 1951. Communists in the Congress and high governmental positions controlled major committees, labor and farm groups, and propaganda facilities. They agitated and led in demonstrations against neighboring countries and the United States.
What was profoundly new in terms of what Bernays did is he took this menace to our backyard in Guatemala. For the first time, we saw Reds a couple hundred miles from New Orleans, who Eddie Bernays had us believing were a true threat to us, that it was going to be a Soviet outpost in our backyard.
But what Bernays was doing was not just trying to blacken the Arbenz regime. He was part of a secret plot. President Eisenhower had agreed that America should topple the Arbenz government, but secretly. The CIA were instructed to organize a coup. Working with the United Fruit Company, the CIA trained and armed a rebel army and found a new leader for the country called Colonel Armas. The CIA agent in charge was Howard Hunt, later one of the Watergate burglars.
What we wanted to do was have a terror campaign to terrify Arbenz particularly, terrify his troops, much as the German Stuka bombers terrified the population of Holland, Belgium, and Poland at the onset of World War II, and just rendered everybody paralyzed.
As planes flown by CIA pilots dropped bombs on Guatemala City, Edward Bernays carried on his propaganda campaign in the American press.
Now, you guys may think this is dark, but they're doing it in the name of freedom and democracy, don't forget. So, you know.
He was preparing the American population to see this as the liberation of Guatemala by freedom fighters for democracy.
he totally understood that the coup would happen when the public and the press, when conditions in the public and the press allowed for a coup to happen, and he created those conditions. He was totally savvy in terms of just what he was helping create there in terms of this overthrow. But ultimately, he was reshaping reality, reshaping public opinion in a way that's undemocratic and manipulative.
Well, what I find interesting, Simon, is that the Americans still try to do these sort of gay ops, as we call them, all the time. But they are now so ham-fisted, so crap at doing this stuff that, I mean, when was the last time they successfully pulled off anything like this?
Ukraine, 2014.
2014, Ukraine, yeah. I mean, I suppose they did. They did manage to get most of the public on side with the Ukraine war. But of course, you've got the internet undercutting everything now, which Benayes did not have to deal with back then.
And you've got the ground plentifully seeded with the idea that, well, that's all just a conspiracy theory, that the idea of governments manufacturing these things in their own interests as a matter of foreign policy is fanciful.
Mm. Yeah. Which I've always found a strange doublethink on the left, because the left, more than anyone, believe that the Americans do these CIA coups.
Mm.
But in the case of Ukraine, no, that's preposterous, fake news, you know. And they hold both those ideas at the same time. Anyway, let's not worry and marvel about the mind of the modern leftist, if there even is such a thing.
On June the 27th, 1954, Colonel Arbenz fled the country, and Armas arrived as the new leader. Within months, Vice President Nixon visited Guatemala. In an event staged by United Fruit's PR department, he was shown piles of Marxist literature that had been found, it was said, in the presidential palace.
This is the first time in the history of the world that the communist government has been overthrown by the people. And for that, we congratulate you and the people of Guatemala for the support they have given. And we are sure that under your leadership, supported by the people whom I have met by the hundreds on my visit to Guatemala, that Guatemala is going to enter a new era in which there will be prosperity for the people together with liberty for the people. Thank you very much for allowing us to see this exhibit of communism in Guatemala.
You're welcome.
And for dinner, see what Mother has for dessert. Banana gingerbread shortcake. Just another of the many tempting ways in which this nutritious fruit can be prepared. So now that you've seen where bananas come from before they reach your table, our journey to Banana Land is ended. We hope you enjoyed the trip. We know you like bananas.
Quite a grim montage, isn't it?
Bernays had manipulated the American people, but he had done so because he, like many others at the time, believed that the interests of business and the interests of America were indivisible, especially when faced with the threat of communism. But Bernays was convinced that to explain this rationally to the American people was impossible, because they were not rational. Instead, one had to touch on their inner fears and manipulate them in the interests of a higher truth. He called it the engineering of consent.
He was doing it for the American way of life, and to which he was devoted. So this sincerely devoted, and yet he felt the people were really pretty stupid. And that's the paradox. If you don't leave it up to the people themselves, but force them to choose what you want them to choose, however subtly, then it's not democracy anymore. It's something else. It's being told what to do. It's that old authoritarian thing.
You get a bit idealistic, Benayes Jr. Pipe down, woman, I say.
There's interesting examples of cultural seeding that go on, especially throughout the 50s. to raise this anxiety of the Red Scare. And obviously it's shot through in things like, you know, science fiction films, obviously, you know, the threat from outer space of, you know, many kinds explored in various tropes. But there's a little bit of a doggerel from a chap called Gerhard Williams, who was the governor of Michigan in 1957, which is sort of typical of the era and the raised anxiety levels. It was when they launched the Soviets launched Sputnik. And this was, you know, just a Earth orbiting satellite, you know, and I think that you could perhaps tune in on the radio and you could pick up the beep coming from the satellite. And there was this little bit of poetry he said at the time. It was, "Oh, little Sputnik flying high with made in Moscow beep. You tell the world it's a commie sky and Uncle Sam's asleep." So.
You know, in the 60s, there was a lot of paranoia around. In the especially in the song lyrics of various different 60s songwriters, it's flecked through with a kind of, I mean, these days we'd call it schizo conspiracy or paranoia, or this sense that there are dark forces in the government that are kind of against the people.
Yeah.
So it was sensed. They were kind of justified in that, weren't they?
Yeah. We're going to come right up against this when it gets to the bit about Marcuse at the end of the documentary. Yeah.
But the idea that it was necessary to manipulate the inner feelings of the American population in the interests of fighting the Cold War now began to take root in Washington. Above all, in the CIA, who were going to take it much further. They were concerned that the Soviets were experimenting with psychological methods to actually alter the memories and feelings of people, the aim being to produce more controllable citizens.
Now, we've encountered this before, haven't we?
Yeah.
Where this was this from?
It was in Pandora's Box. It was for a fish long enough, I think.
Yeah, one of the Pandora's Box episodes.
The really dark one, yeah.
Oh, bloody hell, that was dark. That was another 10 out of 10, Curtis, that whole episode, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, but this was the obsession that was sort of justified at the time, as we know the Soviets are looking into these things like automatic obedience, trying to foster automatic obedience in citizens. And really, you know, this is kind of the CIA justifying it on the grounds that this is what the Soviets are doing. But actually, it's just a dry run of techniques of mass control that are going to be rolled out further into the 50s and 60s. Which is where you get into all the kinds of, you know, MK Ultra stuff, which is not conspiratorial. These things really happened, where in that particular project, they were rolling out things like LSD and various psychoactive chemicals on people without their consent, you know, on civic populations and on people in places like prisons and places in the military. So this was all sort of getting underway now. They kind of, you know, very much forgotten about the Nuremberg protocols about, you know, the consent of the human subject. They were really sort of taking the reins off at this point.
There's a guy in the chat, Simon, who's saying Marcuse, the fifth Beatle. Well, let's see now. There was Theodore, Eric. I'm trying to remember the other one. Eric, Theodore. Who were the other two Beatles? I can't remember any. There was Ergen, wasn't there? I don't know. Maybe Herbert was one of the four Beatles. I'm trying to. All right, let's carry on.
It was known as brainwashing. Psychologists in the CIA were convinced that this really might be possible and that they should try to do it themselves.
The image of the human being that was being built up at that particular time was that there was a great deal of vulnerability in every human being, and that vulnerability could be manipulated to program somebody to be something that I wanted them to be. And they didn't want to be. That you could manipulate people in such a way that they could be automatons, if you will, for whatever your own purposes were. This was the image that people thought was possible.
In the late 50s, the CIA poured millions of dollars into the psychology departments of universities across America. They were secretly funding experiments on how to alter and control the inner drives of human beings. The most notorious of these experiments was run by the head of the American Psychiatric Association, Dr. Ewan Cameron. Like many psychiatrists at that time, Cameron was convinced that inside human beings were dangerous forces which threatened society. But he believed that it was possible not just to control these forces, but actually remove them.
He thought that psychiatry should not just concentrate on sick people, mentally ill, but should actually go into government, that politicians should listen to psychiatrists. Psychiatrists should be in every parliament and should direct and monitor political activities, because they knew in a rational, scientific way what was good for people.
Cameron had set up a clinic in a hospital in Montreal called the Allen Memorial. It is now long since closed down. Cameron took patients who suffered a wide range of mental problems. His theory was that these resulted from forgotten or repressed memories. But he was impatient with the idea of using psychotherapy to uncover them. Instead, he would simply wipe them.
What Curtis loves empty offices. This is one thing we have learned, Simon.
It's these really haunted spaces, yeah. That's it.
An abandoned clinic, you know, with the lights off. Loves it.
This stuff is very real, this program. This is not just you and Cameron. I mean, there's interesting stuff about the predecessors to the CIA, the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services. This was kind of a bit like our SOE during the war, who would carry out special operations. There was a guy who was called Stanley Lovell, who was their head of research and development, and he sort of made a public statement about what they wanted to do here. And he said that his intention was to stimulate the bad boy beneath the surface of every American scientist and to say to him, throw off all your normal law-abiding concepts out of the window. Here's a chance to raise merry hell. And this was this program of using psychoactives, which they'd already been trying to work with marijuana and cocaine previously to see if they could screw people around mentally. And this was just really kicking into high gear. Now they were approaching Sandoz in Switzerland, who were the manufacturers of LSD, which was called Delicid at the time, and saying to them, we want to try this stuff out in the US. And Sandoz said to them, we've only ever produced about 2 ounces of the stuff. So they basically took over suitcases of money and said, right, we want you to produce, you know, a sort of, you know, I don't know, 100 ounces of this stuff. Tell us if anybody else shows an interest. And they brought it back to the US and started, you know, dropping it in people's drinks, literally, to see where it would go.
I'm glad that we're so much more enlightened now that the government doesn't get
it. It would never happen. Absolutely never happen.
Never happen today, would it?
Cameron used drugs, including LSD, and the technique of ECT, electroconvulsive therapy. It was conventionally used at that time to relieve depression. But Cameron was going to use it in a new way, to produce new people.
He was really using it to try and change the fundamental function of the individual, to alter their past memories, their past ways of behaving. And as I think he said at one point, it is to just sort of erase everything from their past so that you then had a slate in which you could record new ways of behavior. And so he used massive doses of shock, of people receiving several shocks a day, and over a course of time, hundreds of ECT treatments, so that they were just reduced to a sort of a very primitive vegetable state.
I don't remember what happened to me. I was introduced to Dr. Cameron, and I don't remember Dr. Cameron at all. I don't remember any of that. They shipped me up to what they called the sleep room, and they gave me all of these electroconvulsive shock treatments and mega doses of drugs and LSD. And
this is like a super edit of the Pandora's Box episode, in like he's got like the best bits in like a little 5-minute package here, hasn't he?
Yeah, what she's going to talk about is this psychic driving experiment where Cameron, he picked up on this, there was this device called a cerebrophone, which was around at the time. And it was used for this thing of sleep learning, you know, this kind of thing of learn Spanish while you sleep, that kind of stuff. And there were all sorts of experiments. This started from sort of the mid to late 40s of using this stuff. One of the funny ones I discovered was they got 20 chronic nail biters and they played them the message, "My nails taste terribly bitter endlessly through the night."
Did it work?
I don't know. It sounds nuts.
It's proper Clockwork Orange, Bull. Proper Clockwork Orange, isn't it, this stuff?
Yeah.
You know, Ludwig van.
All of that, and I have no memory of any of that. Nothing of that time in the Allen Memorial or any of my life previous to that. All gone. Wiped.
And then having depatterned somebody or brought them down to where basically nothing but the essential functions of the body were going on in terms of breathing and things of this nature, then he would begin to feed material into these individuals, positive material, such that the brain would be programmed in a positive way so that the individual would be completely altered.
Then he put these tapes under our pillows called psychic driving. He would then put back into this empty brain a program of whatever sort he decided upon, and the people like myself would wake up another person, I guess.
In fact, Cameron's experiments were a complete disaster. All he managed to produce were dozens of individuals with memory loss and the ability to repeat the phrase, "I am at ease with myself." And it was not an isolated case. Almost all the experiments the CIA funded were equally unsuccessful. Despite their ambitions, American psychologists were beginning to find out how difficult it was to understand and control the inner workings of the human mind.
We had been really chasing a phantom, if you will, an illusion, that the human mind was more capable of manipulation from the outside by outside factors than it is. We found out that the human being is an extremely complex thing. There were no simple solutions. But you've just got to bear in mind that these were very strange times.
You've got to understand that I was the head of dark shit for 24 years. You know?
The interesting thing about this is the metaphor of a car, actually, when you look at a lot of the footage Kirsty's using, a lot of the turns of phrase. I mean, you remember at the beginning of the show, Anna Freud is talking about the royal road to the unconscious. You've got all the images of cars in advertising, and it's one of the big things about this period is it's very clear that American big business is using the car as a kind of avatar for the personality. You know, it takes you where you want to go, but it's a safe space inside. And yet it expresses all these dimensions of yourself. Oh, it's so much bigger. I mean, that footage of the woman, you know, obviously with a great gross sort of sexual undertone, but there are elements of it whereby they're framing a lot of this, again, like we said last week, this transubstantiation of the product into the personality. And the car is this thing which we see all this footage of the cars on the roads. It's something which, you know, you get in it, but it only kind of goes in one direction. You know, it's a kind of a progressive means of transport, but you kind of, in a sense, you don't go backwards. There's an interesting paragraph in that Ken Holling's book I talked about, Welcome to Mars. He talks about Ewan Cameron and about this thing of psychic driving. And he says his passion for new cars is apparent in the term he derives for this new process, psychic driving. It quickly becomes clear that at this time, when the first parkways and interstates are being built across America, the correct model for treating the human mind is no longer the Freud House in Vienna, but General Motors in Detroit.
That's fascinating. And of course, the car being the great American symbol as well. So it's fitting that it is the automobile or the road.
The hook, yeah.
Yeah. I can't help but think of the Tony Blair inevitability doctrine as well. because the destination of the car, you know, it's going to take you where it's going to take you, you know. Yeah. Anyway, let's carry on.
Psychoanalysts had come to power in America because of their theory that they knew how to control the dangerous forces inside human beings. But now the psychoanalysts were about to face a high-profile failure that would lead people to begin questioning the very basis of their ideas. It began in Hollywood. The film industry had become fascinated by psychoanalysis, and Anna Freud was a powerful influence on dozens of analysts in Los Angeles. They treated film stars, directors, and studio bosses. Anna Freud's closest friend was the most sought after of all, Ralph Greenson. And in 1960, the most famous star in the world turned to Greenson for help. Marilyn Monroe was suffering from despair and had become addicted to alcohol and drugs.
Well, when I walked in to dinner, here was Marilyn Monroe. And I'd made a picture with her called All About Eve.
This is dinner at Ralph Greenson's.
Yes. And
now, why is the film All About Eve especially dear to the heart of this channel, Simon?
Well, I know the answer. Does anybody in the chat know who the suave, deep-voiced principal, is he the lead actor, would you say, in the film?
I think he won the Oscar for Best Supporting Actor. So he was a support role. Addison DeWitt, my avatar, George Sanders. And if you go back to my earliest videos, I had scenes from the film over when I would talk. Is from All About Eve, one of my favorite films.
I still think when I tuned into your channel years ago, I thought for a long time you looked like George Sanders. I knew George Sanders was an actor, but I didn't know what he looked like. And I just assumed it was you.
Yeah, well, I still get that. And whenever people see me, we're like, hey, I thought you were 60 years old. And things like that. I was like, I don't know why people think I'm so much older than I am. But,
got a grumpy voice.
So yeah, grumpy voice. And now it's kind of cigar stained as well on top of. But I chose Addison DeWitt not only because I thought he was cool, but he was the only. He's the only. I have a background as a literary critic, as you know, and he was the only critic character I could think of from a film. So when I started the channel, I thought, well, he can be a good stand-in because he is a. I know he was a theatre critic as opposed to a kind of literary scholar, but that's the closest I could think of in any movie. So, you know, I think there's a film called The Wonder Boys that may be about an English professor, but I think it is starring Michael Douglas, but, you know, that's not as he wasn't as cool as Addison DeWitt, you know. And there are some terrific lines in that film from him, you know. I have a contempt for humanity and things like that. Amazing movie. But anyway, let's carry on.
The only thing was that Ralph was trying to show her, Romy, I never called him Ralph in my life. Romy was trying to show her that the way a family life ought really to be. So we were walking the dog after us. I said, what the hell are you doing here? I said, you never asked me to dinner. And he said, you weren't that sick. And I said, oh. No, he said, the point is just this child has no frame of reference. In other words, she doesn't know what the goal is.
What Greenson did was follow Anna Freud's theory. If Marilyn Monroe could be taught to conform to what society considered a normal pattern of life, that would help her ego control her inner destructive urges. But Greenson pushed it to an extreme. He persuaded Monroe to move into a house nearby that was decorated like his own. He then took her into his own family life, and he, his wife, and his daughter played at being Monroe's own family. Greenson himself would become the model of conformity.
And so this...
I think that is such a weird thing to do. Mm. Think about it. Very strange thing to do to a vulnerable woman like Marilyn Monroe.
But it has those parallels, as we saw in last week, in the politics of Europe in the 30s, where these nations were trying to overcome crisis by adopting the father leader. Again, it's the superego, the parent coming in, and they sort of vacillate over this course of, you know, these couple of episodes between trying to embrace that and trying to reject that. And obviously Marcuse is someone who's going to come along and reject that. But, you know, that's an attempt for her to try and incorporate elements into a personality in which she was clearly deeply disturbed.
Had she been married to Arthur Miller at this point?
I believe so, yes.
That already failed, that marriage, did it?
Yeah. And it's a strange mismatch, isn't it, when you consider how Arthur Miller comes across. I think we're going to see a clip of him talking and how Marilyn Monroe comes across. So.
Do you think Marilyn Monroe, how can I put this? Do you think she ever thought, how am I so surrounded by people like Arthur Miller and these people that I'm going to, like, at what point in my life did I become surrounded with all of these, all of these types of characters around me? Anyway, let's continue.
Someone whom she regarded as important and whom she idealized, if he turned out to be a very gratifying father figure, her ego would benefit from that. That was the theory. His wife and children, everyone was involved in it. They were strengthening the person. They were strengthening the mind. They were strengthening the agent that controls inner life against adversity, against insufficiency, against too much frustration. So that Marilyn Monroe would no longer be a helpless person looking for love. She'd have enough love.
But despite all his efforts, Greenson was unable to help Marilyn Monroe. On August the 5th, 1962, she committed suicide in her house.
Fucking hell. I mean, that's what, one way of looking at it is that he failed. Another way is maybe I don't want to live with creepy family anymore.
Yeah.
Creepy surrogate family.
It's interesting, isn't it? The sort of mounting list of casualties of psychoanalytic approaches, you know, the Burlingham children, Marilyn Monroe, no doubt many others.
The suicide shocked many in the analytic community, including Anna Freud. And high-profile figures in American life, who had previously been enthusiasts for psychoanalysis, now began to question why psychoanalysis had become so powerful in America. Was it really because it benefited individuals? Or had it in fact become a form of constraint in the interests of social order? The critics included Monroe's ex-husband, Arthur Miller.
My argument with so much psychoanalysis is the preconception that suffering is a mistake, or a sign of weakness, or a sign even of illness, when in fact, possibly the greatest truths we know have come out of people's suffering. That the problem is not to undo suffering or to wipe it off the face of the earth, but to make it inform our lives instead of trying to cure ourselves of it constantly and avoid it, and avoid anything but that lobotomized sense of what they call happiness. There's too much of an attempt, it seems to me, to think in terms of controlling man rather than freeing him, of defining him rather than letting him go. Mm-hmm. And it's part of the whole ideology of this age, which is power mad.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Miller has a more Chad physiognomy than you kind of think. You think of him as being this kind of little guy with glasses next to Marilyn Monroe or whatever. But looking at him there and comparing him to lots of people today, he looked pretty Chad to me. You know, you can kind of see what she might have been attracted to him in him, you know, I think.
I agree.
Hey, have you heard about the crazy new way to send a message today? It's flashed on a screen too quick to see.
But still you get it subliminally.
At the same time, an onslaught was launched on the way psychoanalysis was being used by business to control people. The first blow came with a bestseller, The Hidden Persuaders, written by Vance Packard. It accused psychoanalysts of reducing the American people to emotional puppets whose only function was to keep the mass production lines running. They did this by manipulating people's unconscious desires to create longings for ever new brands and models. They had turned the population into unwitting participants in the system of planned obsolescence. The second blow came from an influential philosopher and social critic, Herbert Marcuse. He had been trained in psychoanalysis.
This is a childish application of psychoanalysis, which does not take at all into consideration the very real political, systematic waste of resources, of technology, and of the productive process. For example, planned obsolescence. For example, the production of innumerable brands and gadgets who are, in the last analysis, all the same. The production of innumerable different marks of automobiles. And this prosperity at the same time, consciously or unconsciously, leads to a kind of schizophrenic existence. Mm.
This is one of the most interesting things about quote-unquote dissident right, Simon, which I've always been fascinated by, which is the kind of mirror of Frankfurt School. You know, I mean, there's a kind of reactionary element in Marcuse and all of these, and Adorno, who were also railing against the mass society and also had their problems with all of this.
Yes.
And so much of what they say could be a modern NRX essay, you know, just viewed from a slightly different angle, you know. My theory on that is that the postmodern bit, and I've argued this before as well, I'm sure me and you talked about it, was actually stolen from the counter-enlightenment right by the left for a while, and now is just kind of being returned to its natural home. You know, because it starts with people like Vico and even Spengler and people like that. And in a way, I mean, okay, yes, there's the authoritarian personality type and the specific kind of agenda of the Frankfurt School. But many other aspects of their critiques and ideas are still relevant. I mean, my ideas about Trumpdom could be taken straight from Eric Fromm, you know, as an example, you know. So it's kind of, I've always been interested in that strange and unexpected crossover between two schools of thought that you would think would be polar opposites, but in fact have probably more in common than they do not in common.
Well, what's interesting about Marcuse, and he's going to probably feature more in the next episode, is that he famously has this idea of repressive tolerance. But what it effectively really means is that he associates essentially, if you put it this way, the elements of the right, as we would understand it, with psychological repression, if I understand him correctly. And that it's the duty of a proper society to actually be intolerant of that repression that's being conveyed. And so therefore there is a unidirectional antipathy towards the right, where he says it's absolutely proper to suppress the right. There's an interesting quote I found from him. It says, liberating tolerance then would mean intolerance against movements from the right and toleration of movements from the left. Surely no government can be expected to foster its own subversion. Ah, well, we know better. But in a democracy, such a right is vested in the people, i.e. the majority of the people. This means that the ways should not be blocked on which a subversive majority could develop. And if they are blocked by organized repression and indoctrination, their reopening may require apparently undemocratic means. They would include the withdrawal of toleration of speech and assembly from groups and movements that promote aggressive policies, armament, chauvinism, discrimination on the grounds of race and religion, or that oppose the extension of public services, social security, medical care, etc. That's very much of the moment, I would say, in his...
Maybe Keir Starmer is a devotee, right? But from his own point of view, he is correct.
Yes.
And all I would do is completely invert that and be like, in a healthy society, you just have to completely have an intolerance of subversive ideas.
Freedom of speech isn't for everybody.
Yeah, I mean, it's for friends and not for enemies, right? I mean, but you see, once you understand that, I was writing an email to someone who wanted some book recommendations earlier on, and I recommended him some stuff, Eveler on Jazz, right? Mm. Now, there's this other book I've got by Martha Boyle called Hole in the Soul, and basically, she says exactly the same things as Eveler about jazz in America. Mm. Only where Eveler says, and that's a bad thing, she says, and that's a good thing, we should celebrate it. Mm. But the pivotal point is that Eveler and that Martha Boyle's basically agree on the fundamental facts. It's just one is against and one is for.
Yes.
And so in a strange way, they have more in common than the dastardly bourgeois center-right,
yes,
basically, who lie and, you know, have the falsest point of view of all, if that makes any sense.
So. Yeah, the liberal sort of equivocation, the desire to kind of, you know, instantiate fairness as an ideological principle, when in fact it's a completely unrealistic principle if you want to cohere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and for all of these reasons, I have more respect for Marxists than I do for kind of center-right conservatives, you know, and I always have done. Anyway, let's continue.
I believe that in this society, an incredible quantum of aggressiveness and destructiveness is accumulated precisely because of the empty prosperity, which then... simply erupts.
Marcuse's argument was not simply that psychoanalysis had been used for corrupt purposes, it was more fundamental. Marcuse said that the very idea that you needed to control people was wrong. Human beings did have inner emotional drives, but they were not inherently violent or evil. It was society that made these drives dangerous by repressing and distorting them. Anna Freud and her followers had increased that repression by trying to make people conform to society. In so doing, they made people more dangerous, not less.
Marcuse challenged that social world, and he said that's a world that should not be adapted to. And in fact, what the individual was adapting to was corrupt and evil and corrupting. In other words, he switched the source of evil from inward conflict to the society itself. That the sickness of society lay at the society level, not at the sickness of human beings in it. And if people did not challenge that, then they were in fact submitting to evil.
Pause there.
Modern psychology has...
Is that not the sort of crux of the boomer truth dialectic that you've outlined previously, that the figure that Marcuse is talking about, let's say the emblematic enemy of Marcuse, is someone like, you know, the father, the ex-military father in American Beauty, the mm-hmm. repressed, hyper-masculine, sexually confused, white American male, and that the engagement that's going to happen over the next couple of decades is that form of society in a tension with this form of liberation that Marcuse is advocating, but only in this one specific direction. That seems to be, you know, the sort of genesis of this moment, that you know, this turning point. Marcuse comes and says, no, we have to inflect it away from that towards this freewheeling, you know, left libertarian view of challenge everything, but not really challenge everything.
Mm. Yeah, very interesting. Very interesting indeed. Look who's turned up. It's Martin Luther King, my hero.
Just on time.
I always judge people on the content of their character, but that's exactly the problem, Simon.
The interesting thing about this clip is listening to his voice. He uses his voice in a very seductive, sing-song kind of way. He's just interesting as an example of a political speaker. I'm not going to talk about his content, just the way he speaks is interesting.
A word that is probably used more than any other word in psychology. It is the word maladjusted. It is the ringing cry of modern child psychology, maladjusted. Now, of course, we all want to live the well-adjusted life in order to avoid neurotic and schizophrenic personalities. But as I move toward my conclusion, I would like to say to you today, in a very honest manner, that there are some things in our society and some things in our world for which I'm proud to be maladjusted. And I call upon all men of goodwill to be maladjusted to these things until the good society is realized. I must honestly say to you that I never intend to adjust myself to racial segregation and discrimination.
I'm very happy to be maladjusted to the society that we live in today, Simon.
Ditto.
The society that these people have created, I mean...
I never intend to adjust myself to religious bigotry. I never intend to adjust myself to economic conditions that will take necessities from the many to give luxuries to the few and leave millions of God's children smothering in an airtight cage of poverty in the midst of an affluent society.
Pause there. It's just lovely little patterning in his speech there, that when he says an affluent society, I think he's doing a little bit of a wordplay, the mix of affluent and effluent, I think, when he's doing a little bit of subtle social criticism there. But it's interesting he's got that preacher man thing on.
Yeah, no, I mean, that cadence is something that basically all Black American politicians have tried to model their speech on since. Even Obama did it sometimes, didn't he? Where he'd slip into the MLK cadence, you know.
It's kind of what's called, in Shakespearean theatre, old actors like John Gielgud would talk about him singing the verse, as it were. And that's kind of what you're doing. It's kind of you're lulling people with, your Foundations of Rhetoric covers it, but it's certainly a form of delivery that is perhaps underhandedly and sneakily used in the delivery of rhetoric.
Yeah, I mean, there's probably a very interesting stream or essay or something or study to be written on the cross-section of American preachers, various different backgrounds, not just the Black ones, but all of the different types of churches they have in America. So the sermon, right? And the American sales pitch as well, and then American political speeches, that there's some sort of triangle there where those three things are not a million miles away from each other. And if I had talked about this before, I am always fascinated by the number of pro wrestlers who, don't forget, they have their entire careers working the marks. Right, they're working the crowd, they're working the marks, and part of their skills is cutting promos to the crowd. Right, a huge number of pro wrestlers go on to become pastors of some sort or born again Christians, and they work the church circuit almost like they were booking wrestling dates, you know, almost like they used to work the wrestling circuit. They've just swapped one gig for another gig. And I've always been fascinated by how easily that transition works. But of course, the transition from politics to from wrestling to politics, I've talked about before. But the transition from the pulpit to politics is also interesting to me. So anyway, let's carry on.
The political influence of the Freudian psychoanalysts was over. Instead, they were now accused of having helped to create a repressive form of social control. Anna Freud and Dorothy Burlingham lived on in Sigmund Freud's old house in London. In 1970, Dorothy's son Bob died of alcoholism. And in 1973, his sister Mabby returned for yet more analysis with Anna Freud.
She went back for more analysis. She was living at 20 Marysville Gardens in the Freud house, as I guess she did when she wasn't with her husband, and she committed suicide. She took an overdose of sleeping pills.
In Freud's own house?
In Freud's own house, right. So, I mean, there are a lot of implications that one can draw from that, and I just think she happened to reach the end of the rope there. Although it would seem to be a very pointed act. Obviously, suicide is a very politicized act, and to do it in Sigmund Freud's own house is certainly different from doing it in Riverdale back in New York.
Next week's episode will tell the story of the rise to power of the enemies of the Freud family. They believed that the way to build a better society was to let the self free. But what they didn't realize was that this idea of liberation would provide business and politics with yet another way to control the self, by feeding its infinite desires.
You know not what it means to be blue. Someday you'll realize and pay for all those lies. Then you'll know what it means to be blue.
Absolutely peak Curtis, Simon. Curtis.
Totally. I just want to end cap that with a bit of an afterword. Curtis talking there about the way business is going to transform into feeding the endless desires, you know, of the id. Interesting line from an advertising conference in Chicago back in 1954. One of the speakers talks about the power of selling to children, because we're talking about the baby boomers. They're still the babies at this point. Mm-hmm. And he says in this quote from this conference, he talks about children, basically consumers born after 1947, so classic baby boomers, says, "The child has brand loyalty and the determination to see that his parents purchase the product of his choice." You know, and another afterword again from Ken Hollings, that Welcome to Mars book, that I think sums up this moment where this inflection point where Marcuse comes in and this tension is set up for the baby boomers. He says about this period in history, what had begun as a consumerist trend was fast turning into an evolutionary tide that threatened to surge and break over existing society, transforming it forever. At home in the suburbs, enough to contemplate leaving it behind forever. Adept at existing in an electronic universe of recording and playback, the children born between 1947 and 1959 represented an unforeseen development in the internal divisions that characterized the Cold War. Not for nothing would they be referred to as baby boomers. The rhetorical switch from missile gap to generation gap had done its work only too well. History is the price we pay for progress. If the future should ever come to stay again, it will only be to haunt us. So something about this particular moment, I think, is kind of key to the thesis.
Very, very, very interesting. And of course, society would never recover from the baby boomers, as we have found out to our entire life's experience. Just a few super chats, Simon. Chris Primer says, I want to see a modern remake of the Andy Griffith Show where the sheriffs battle drug cartels and out-of-town Marxists. Otis can have a fentanyl addiction and Barney can be gay but black.
Well, the drug cartels in this period are interesting because, you know, you think it's the government, basically. You know, I found there was a list of drugs that they were using in these experiments on people, not just LSD. They were using secanol, dexedrine, sodium pentothal, thiamine, scopolamine, the truth drug, atropine sulfate, sodium luminol, and caffeine sulfate as agents of influence. So that's where you're getting your drugs.
O2 Tom says, surely some people at the BBC must have been aware of what Curtis was hinting at. Is he just too clever, though, Simon, to be for that to be detected? Hard to say, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I think as you go on through watching the series of Curtis documentaries, maybe there's something to be charted about his progress. But I just don't know. As I said, Century of the Self is difficult to find out much about where Curtis was at the time. But I mean, it's certainly like his eyes were kind of bulging like dinner plates at the stuff he was coming up against. And I think that's why I said this was such a influential documentary series for me, especially this idea of playing with perception and reality.
Belfrost Knight says, did you know that 30 to 40% of the population has an inner monologue? Also, 5% has aphantasia. They can't imagine an apple in their mind. Think about this. I do know about that because one of my biggest tweets of all time was basically me saying that people who don't have an internal monologue should be enslaved. Which, you know, typical OG Roland Rat hyperbole, of course, but I was only joking. But I still kind of... I mean, how can someone who doesn't have an internal monologue have the same kind of rights, responsibilities, political representation as people who do?
All views expressed on the Academic Agent channel are a mere ludic academic provocation.
A kind of exercise in postmodern entertainment, isn't that right,
yes.
Simon?
We're reimagining truth all the time.
Indeed. It's like when David Brent makes a racist comment and then looks sideways at the camera.
Yeah.
But Ricky Gervais is saying, listen, I know it's wrong to be racist, and so do you. And you think he's joking, and you think you're joking. But then you think, is he joking? Maybe he's not joking.
Our irony cup runneth over.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? And that, you know, maybe we're trapped in that moment of 2002 where we were all comfortable with such irony rabbit holes as that. But Glow in the Dark says it's true that you can manipulate people based urges against them. My problem with it is by continuously doing it, you become reliant on it. Once the magic is gone, it's hard to get back if people distrust. But the thing is, you've got to remember, it's continually different people all the time. And after long enough, you've got somebody for life, haven't you? I mean, I think they've got the boomers for life. There are certain things that you'll never convince a boomer of, no. Certain boomer truths that are so core that they literally kind of spaz out if you even try to go near them. So yeah. It's pointless to even go there with most boomers.
And by transliteration across the generations with Gen X as well, you know, as you've made the point before, I mean, I see it in my own cohort. I'm sure, you know, it's implanted in other descending generations to some extent. So, you know, if our hope lies anywhere, it lies in the Zoomers, to paraphrase Orwell.
And I think that is it for the Super Chats, mercifully. So we can get out of here. Simon, where can people find you, sir?
At Simon_Roberts, please subscribe to all the channels of our friends hereabouts. And thank you very much for listening once again.
Yeah, fascinating. And I mean, I'm really interested in getting into the 60s stuff next week as well.
Yeah.
Although there's a possibility, Simon, that due to various things, we may have to postpone next week until the 21st. But I'll cross that bridge when it comes. I may be having to be on childcare duty as somebody is taken to the hospital. I'll just put it that way. So,
well, delayed gratification is an important thing to learn that boomers probably sometimes struggle with.
Yes, and unfortunately, things like that always seem to happen on Wednesdays. I don't know why it is. Deepest Lore is always the most movable of all the feasts, unfortunately, even as it's become many people's favourite show. It's like kind of Connoisseur's Choice, you know? Connoisseur's Choice.
Yes.
And Anyway, do buy courses at the academic agency, promo code Scorcher, 25% off. You know, some of you may be thinking that you don't want to take the Trivium, but actually you do. And I'll leave you on that note. get out, everybody.
Enjoy get your out. Riots.
Or lack of them, as it yes. seems to be turning out.
What goes on in this town is none of your business.
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Then maybe you shouldn't be living here!
Well, that's easily fixed.